and start our discussion of excise taxes. Mr. Yates.
Mr. Chair.
You can say Aunt Paul.
Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. To talk a little bit about sort of orientation on excise taxes. Excise taxes basically are, well, taxes, first of all, are basically an imposition of a fee or charge which is intended to produce general fund revenue. So you get the distinction between fees, which are sort of cost of service type impositions, which are intended to cover the cost of providing the service. But once you start raising revenue for general purposes from those fees, they become taxes. And basically, you've got three types of taxes. The income tax, where the base is essentially some measure of taxable income. Sales taxes, where the base is the value of the product which is sold. And then excise taxes, which in general are imposed on the item purchased. So it's on the volume of purchase as opposed to the value of the purchase. Cigarette taxes, for example, are per cigarette that you purchase. They're not sensitive to the value of the product. So we've lumped a lot of things in here, I have here, in terms of excise taxes. Most of them fit that model. Some of them don't. And we'll see sort of as we go through where they do not exactly fit the model. There's four areas that I'm going to cover. Tobacco taxes, cigarette, I'll go into what those are in a second, and then taxes on alcoholic beverages. These are through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, where they impose privilege taxes on products that are distributed in the private sector. Wine and beer, for example, are distributed through private wholesalers and through retail, regular grocery store and other retail outlets. They pay a privilege tax. Alcohol, which has more than 21%, or beverages which have more than 21% of alcohol, are distributed both at the wholesale and retail level by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. At the retail level, they use agents, essentially, to distribute it. And so there is no tax on that, but I've included in the discussion here the profits that come from OLC operations, so I treat it as if it were an excise tax. Telecommunications, the main tax, and the only one I cover there, is the 911 emergency communications tax, and that, again, is on a unit basis. If you have a phone which has access to the 911 emergency communication network, it's subject to a tax. The other tax, as I threw in here, are fuel taxes, because they are per gallon of fuel that you purchase. Within the tobacco taxes, we get revenue from cigarette taxes, from other tobacco products, and that includes basically snuff, chewing tobacco, pipe tobacco, cigars. And then, again, another item I've included is the revenue that comes to Oregon from the Master Settlement Agreement. Now, this is revenue from a legal agreement, so it's not a tax, but it behaves essentially as if it were an excise tax imposed by a group of states and then allocated back to the individual members.
Do you know what percentage excise taxes are of our overall budget?
A lot of these get distributed back to local governments, and they may be more important there, but they're pretty small with respect to the general fund budget. The liquor apportionment appears as a separate item on there, and we can pull that out. And the cigarette taxes also appear. Most of the other taxes, like 911, are other funds. They're not general fund revenue. So it's about those two in a fairly small proportion.
So these tend to be more dedicated.
Yeah. History of the cigarette tax. Go back to 1967. The rate was 4%. And at that time, it was 2 cents that went to the state general fund and 1 penny each to cities and counties. The next three increases there, or the next two increases, were just increases in the portion going to the general fund. increasing from 2 cents to 7, and then it's 17. And then in 86, there was an increase, a small further increase in the state portion to 21 cents, and doubling of the portion going to local government, so the 2 cents each went to cities and counties. As we move to 1990, then, the state rate went up a penny, let me go back to 86 for a moment. What happened there is the city and county distributions went to 3 cents for a total of 6 cents. As we move into 1980, that 6 cents was divided three ways rather than two ways. It went to cities and counties, but also to the Department of Transportation for distribution back to local governments for senior and disabled transit. So now you have, at this time, you have 2 cents each for cities, counties, and transit. And that's pretty much remained constant up until this last change in November of 2002. So in 94, the state rate goes up. The state rate remained at 22 cents. And what you have there is the first temporary tax for support of the health plan, which was 10 cents. And that was had a sunset on it, and that sunset has been extended each biennium. And you have to deal with that question again this biennium.
There is so the sunset is up this time on that 10 cents?
Yes. Then with Measure 44 in 1997, there was an initiative petition that put that on the ballot, and what it did was increase the tax by 30 cents. 27 cents of that went into the health plan, and 3 cents went into TURA over here, the Tobacco Use Reduction Account, basically going for programs to encourage people to stop smoking. Then last November, you referred, and it was passed, a cigarette tax increase as of November 1, which added another 60 cents. And most of that went into the health plan with minor adjustments, as we'll see in the other distributions. If you look at where Oregon ranks, there's two ways to do this. It's not clear which is preferable. One is to just look at the excise rates. The other is to recognize that in most of these states, there's also a sales tax piled on top of that. And since Oregon doesn't have a sales tax, you know, what is the appropriate comparison? It's not quite clear which one is most relevant. Anyway, if you look just at excise taxes, at 68 cents, the listing I have was as July 1, 2002. Now, they're increasing all over the country. But as of that time, Oregon was 18th at 68 cents. And we would, at $1.28 where we are now, we would move into fourth place if everybody else were to remain constant, which has not happened. If you add the sales tax, then Oregon moves down to 23rd. On this graph, the light blue is the excise tax and the dark blue is the sales tax added. And you can see that there are other states that don't have sales taxes as well. But a lot of the states with lower excise taxes, when you combine the sales tax, they move above Oregon. Again, this would be as of July 1, 2002. And at $1.28, which we are now, again, Oregon would still move into fifth place. For the last fiscal year, 2001-2002, the total revenue from cigarettes was $155 million. Of that, 32% went to the general fund, 55% into the health plan, 4% into the tobacco use reduction, and 9% distributed to those three local governmental sources, cities, counties, and senior and disabled transit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Yates, whenever we've talked about this in previous revenue discussions, you've always had a discussion about the elasticity of these tax increases. Did you see any change in what you may have predicted the total take was going to be versus what it ended up being?
From this last 60 cents, there's not been enough time to make any judgment.
Okay.
The estimate, of course, did include an estimate of how much volume would be reduced as a result of the price change. The model not only uses an elasticity, but it also is sensitive to the border population and the rates in surrounding states. And Washington, of course, increased, and so we're not that much different. There is quite a bit of difference between Idaho, which is still at 28 cents. They're talking about an increase, but they're still at 28 cents. And California, I'm not sure where they are. I think they passed increases, but I don't know if they've taken effect yet. But the model takes that into consideration. But it's going to take a year anyway to really evaluate whether or not it was sufficiently or too sensitive in terms of its adjustments.
Okay. Thank you. I won't ask you any more questions for the rest of the day, I promise, Mr.
He'll break that promise in about 5 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I resemble that remark.
You got it.
So right now we have three taxes, essentially, in law. What I call a 58-cent permanent tax, and that's just the 60-cent new tax is permanent also, but I wanted to separate the two. So the 58-cent, which has been in effect for quite a while, has a certain distribution pattern. 38% of that essentially goes into the general fund and about 47% into the health plan. And since Measure 44, you've got about 5% into the tobacco use reduction and 10% going to local governments. The temporary tax is 100% into the health plan. And the new 60-cent tax that you passed, almost all of it, 97.9%, goes into the health plan. And the reason for these small increases going to the tobacco use reduction account and to the local governments is to compensate for that elasticity factor. If they were to continue to get 3 cents as the tobacco use reduction account basically gets from the 58-cent tax, the new tax forces volume down, forces the retail price of the product up, consumption down, so at that 3 cents they get less money. So the legislature last session distributed a small percentage here, 0.7% and 1.4% to those other governmental units to try to hold a constant, essentially, the revenue stream that they would have gotten. So when you add all these up, essentially you've got 17% of the tax on cigarettes going to the general fund, 75% into the health plan, 2.7% to the factory use reduction, and 5.3% local governments. If you just sort of look for the upcoming biennium, since that history is does not really reflect the, in terms of the revenues generated, does not reflect the increase in the tax, I went to our forecast here, essentially, which is from DASA's forecast of cigarette tax revenues. For the 2003-05 biennium, it's estimated, the cigarette tax is estimated to produce $493 million. And this is just the proportion of the rates. It says 58 cents raises this amount, the 10 cents this amount, and the 60 cents the dark blue. Where does the money go? Well, about $90 million is going to go into the general fund. About $361 will be dedicated to the health plan. About $14 million into the tobacco use reduction. And then about $28 million to be split three ways among the local governments.
Mr. Yates, the tobacco use reduction, is that a state agency? I understand this isn't your exact the agency, but does it go to a state account and then disperse county on a per rata basis? Or
I look that up every once in a while and then I forget, but it does go into the health division and thereby, and from that point it's distributed, parts of it at least, back to local governments. Yeah. And it also goes out in grants, I think, as far as producing programs which are aimed at tobacco cessation. Just trying to look sort of over time at what's happened to taxable distributions of cigarettes. This is population, the black line essentially is the growth of population over this period. And if per capita consumption were to remain constant, one would expect taxable distributions to sort of parallel that increase in population. What you find is a reduction in taxable distributions, and the question that raises is whether or not per capita consumption has actually gone down, or whether we have some non-compliance problem in terms of people smoking cigarettes that are not taxed. And this sort of behavior that's occurred over this time, and the fact that we have some sample data and other types of information that indicate that while cigarette consumption may be going down, it's not going down that fast, led the legislature essentially to put together a task force, including the Department of Revenue, State Police, and the Department of Justice, to try and get their hands around this issue as to whether or not there is significant non-compliance, to figure out ways essentially to increase compliance if there is a problem. And we'll hear from them this session, and the continued funding of that operation will be a subject to this session. The other reason that you might expect some decrease in consumption, this is just the consumer price index, the dark blue lines, and then the light blue lines is the price of cigarettes in Oregon. And as you can see, there's been a dramatic increase, even relative to prices generally, in the price of cigarettes. And economic theory at least suggests that when the price goes up, consumption is going to go down. Other tobacco products. Now here we violate a little bit the idea of an excise tax, because we're imposing the tax not on cigars or ounces of chewing tobacco or ounces of pipe tobacco, but on the wholesale price of the product. So what we really have is sort of a wholesale tax rate, but we're still treating it as an excise tax, and it is generally treated that way. And a lot of states do, in fact, still have taxes that are per cigar or per ounce of product consumed. History of the tax, essentially it was passed in 1985 at 35% of the wholesale price. The first change then was under ballot measure 44 in 1997, when that was increased to 65 cents. The original 35 cent went to the general fund. That continues to go to the general fund. The increase, 27 percentage points, go into the health plan, and 3 percentage points essentially the tobacco use reduction. Those are not percents of the total, but of the 65 cents that's imposed, percent which is imposed on the wholesale price, 27% is for the health plan. The last change then, I can't really show in this type of chart. Last session you said, okay, this is, we'll leave the tax at 65 cents, but we're going to limit the tax on each cigar to 50 cents. So it's 65% of wholesale price up to 50 cents per cigar. And what that looks like, if you look, I assume in general a 20% retail markup on other tobacco products. It's lower for cigarettes. The information I have suggests about a 20% markup. It varies, of course, depending upon what the seller is. But if you do that, essentially it's here at about $1.06 retail where you hit the 50-cent tax. So up to that point, it would be 65% of the wholesale price. Then as you move into the quality cigars, where you're getting up to, say, about $2 per cigar retail, then the tax is limited to 50 cents. It would otherwise be that point on the chart is, that's $2. So, no, wait a minute. It's $1.01. So the tax is reduced 51%, reduced by about 1%. Where Oregon ranks, again, this comparison, as I said, is harder. Most states that impose a tax on cigarettes have exactly the same type of tax as Oregon, just at a different rate. But taxes on other tobacco products differ significantly in the way they're levied. So there's a number of states down here which are just blank, and that's because they've got, you know, 6 cents per cigar less than 3 inches, 7 cents if it's over 8 inches or something. And there's no way that I can reasonably compare those with Oregon. But among those which have the tax either based on manufactured price or wholesale price, I've made a comparison here, and Oregon comes out third at 65%. And these were as of January 1 of last year. I'm trying to think of whether there's been any increases, but I don't think so. The highest one, Washington here, I think, yeah, that's its current rate. It's about a little over a doubling in the wholesale price. Other tobacco products in the last fiscal year raised $20.1 million, so substantially less. We had, from cigarettes, we had $155 million, so you're getting $20 million out of other tobacco products. And most of that goes into the general fund. And then the ballot measure 44 increases, 42% of the total goes to the health plan, 5% to the tobacco use reduction account. Again, just looking at the history, what you have in the beginning is just the state and the local government share. Then beginning in 1985, I guess it is, you begin that local share gets split up between cities, counties, and transit. And then as you move into the 90s, you pick up the temporary tax to support the health plan, and then in 97 you begin to get substantially more tax supporting the health plan plus the tobacco use reduction account. And you can kind of see where the tax is increased and how consumption falls off and the tax is increased. And, that's kind of the behavior, essentially, of that tax.
So was the TURA, the tobacco use reduction monies, was that approved by voters in an initiative that was...
Everything but the small additional amount that went from the last 60 cents. Mm-hmm. But the original approval was in the initiative, ballot measure 44.
It was written in the initiative.
Yes. The master settlement agreement, now that we have more members here, I want to also encourage you to look actually in our Oregon Public Finance Basic Facts document. A lot of these slides are pictures, but the actual numbers are in the document if you want those. With respect to the Master Settlement Agreement, we have Research Report 9-02, which again is intended to give you some background on what the nature of what the Master Settlement Agreement is. Basically, what we had back in 97 was a bandwagon, I guess, if you like, where all states were going into court and suing the major manufacturers of tobacco. As a result of this, four states actually settled their own cases, and 47 states and four principal manufacturers, which at that time had 96.4% of the market, those four manufacturers in the 47 states entered into an agreement. And that agreement is called the Master Settlement Agreement or Master Tobacco Settlement Agreement. And as I said, there were four firms in here to begin with: Philip Morse, R.J. Reynolds, Brown and Williamson's, and Lorillard. What can happen as a result of that agreement is you can have subsequent participating members, which means other people who enter the market or who are in this original 3.6%, who might agree to the terms of that. In other words, they're going to make similar payments to the states as if they were a member of that agreement. Those are called subsequent participating manufacturers. The other option then is what's called a non-participating manufacturer, and those are people who sell, say, cigarettes within a state but do not were not original members or have not agreed to abide by the agreement. The result of this agreement is annual payments in perpetuity. So long as the agreement is not, you know, violated in some sense and rendered inactive, these payments will continue forever. The amount of the payments, however, are subject to adjustment. The dollar amounts and sort of basis were set out in the agreement, but the intention was not that those amounts would ever be paid, because they knew there would be adjustments. And the adjustments are also laid out in the agreement. Major adjustments, I guess, I was trying to think of what the next slide was. Major adjustments here are four. One is just to account for the fact that four states agreed separately. And so there's an adjustment which reduces. The dollar amounts which went in there sort of where the total payments were going to go to everybody. So there is an adjustment for previously settled suits. There's an adjustment for inflation, which says that those payments, that one portion of these payments at least, will go up annually by the larger of 3% or the consumer price index. So they go up at least 3%. Consumer price index is higher, they'll go up by the amount of that index. The other major adjustment is a volume adjustment, and that is for the original participating members and the subsequently participating members. As their share of the market changes, there'll be adjustments to their payments. Now, what we expect is that the share of the major manufacturers will go down, and it has. As it does go down, the amount of payment that they have to make to the state also goes down. The last adjustment here has to do with non-participating members. Essentially, the state also passed a qualifying statute at the time they passed the Master Settlement Agreement, wherein they agreed to force any non-participating manufacturer who's selling cigarettes in the state to make payments into an escrow account. And those payments are just like an excise tax. There's so many mills per cigarette that they sell in the state. They have to put into an escrow account. The money that's in that escrow account remains in the account for 25 years. At the end of 25 years, each year it's put in, it remains for 25 years. At the end of that period, it reverts back to the manufacturer. Put in a year later, that 25 years is extended a year, so it's a rolling 25 years. Now, the manufacturer cannot spend anything out of that escrow account during those 25 years, except to make payments to a state where there has been litigation against that tobacco company because of the harmful effects, essentially, of their cigarettes being sold in the state. So it's essentially a bond or an amount of money that's out there that the state can access if they bring suit and win that suit against those non-participating manufacturers. So that the original and the participating manufacturers are covered by the agreement, essentially. The non-participating members, some states don't allow the sale of cigarettes by non-participating members. We do. To the extent that they make sales, they're not protected. They're can be sued by the state, and if the state wins a suit against them, there's money out there to pay the state. What the payments look like, let me just comment briefly on the period that I've got over here on the side. As I said, this goes on forever in perpetuity. The first period is just what we've got in the bank. When I did the slide, we've got another payment that just came in January that's not in here. The next row essentially takes us through the end of this biennium, and the reason that's important is because that's all spent already.
Okay. We know, Mr. Yates. Thank you very much for bringing it up.
Was that a question? then a period through which
I love the subjective economics lesson we get here.
Violated his pledge.
It's not a question, it's a statement.
The period before, again, the strategic payments begin out here, the period of 10 years over which the strategic payments are paid, and then essentially from then on. What we have originally is an initial payment which is made for 5 years. And then an annual payment, which is the payment which goes on forever. And those are made into a national escrow account, and Oregon gets a share of those. And Oregon's share is 1.147%. So the total payments that are made into those escrow accounts nationally, Oregon's percent is fixed, and it gets about 1.48%. What we've gotten to date, that is as of June 30th, 2002, is $257.6 million. And what we expect to get on an average annual year between 2002-03 year is $81 million. And that's just an estimate. And basically it's the estimate that I've made. I've gone in and tried to estimate what's going to happen to the prices as well as the volume changes. And that and the non-participating manufacturers adjustment are the only ones I can take into consideration. There are other adjustments that I just can't estimate. Anyway, that brings us to $81 million. And essentially, all of this money, this dates back to the first payment was in 98, I think it was. The 99 legislatures sent out two initiative petitions as to how that money could be spent, and dedicating it to certain the legislature sent out one, and one was created by initiative petition as to how those monies could be spent. Both were defeated. So the money just stayed in the bank because it had not been appropriated. There was no way to spend it. And so then the 2001 legislature appropriated all of that previous money plus the amount of money that they saw coming in during the 2001-03 biennium. And that's essentially the estimate that we have here for the amount of money. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands maybe that we might get in excess of that, but no significant revenue. What you have for the upcoming biennium and the next biennium is essentially $70 million a year coming into Oregon, revenue that Oregon expects to receive. And what the special session did essentially was to arrange for a quasi-public corporation with the purpose of selling $150 million in revenue bonds and depositing by May 1st of this year $150 million into the state school fund. As a part of that legislation, the treasurer is directed to work with the head of DAS, essentially, to sell a portion of the rights to that revenue stream to that nonprofit or to the quasi-public corporation. That process is still being determined. It has not been determined at this point. So all I can talk about is what I think was the legislature's intent at the time they sent the treasurer off to figure this out. And I think that was to essentially pay off that debt as soon as possible. So it would be to sell as much of that revenue stream as they can. One other obligation of that revenue stream is bonds issued by the Oregon Health Sciences University. Again, through referral and passage by the voters, treasurer, I guess, I'm trying to figure out who issues these bonds. The treasurer is allowed to issue $200 million in general obligation bonds. But the way those are going to be paid off is DAS is going to take a portion of this tobacco settlement revenue stream and use that money to pay off those general obligation bonds. So what I'm saying, I expect the treasurer to do and DAS in setting up this corporation is to take all the revenue in excess of that need and use that to pay off the bonds that will be issued by the corporation. So basically, most of that money, again, is gone throughout the next two bienniums. Then as you move down into 2007, we do get for 10 years a separate payment, which is called a strategic payment. And that was my understanding is that's kind of a reward for states that were heavily involved in a litigation. Anyway, for Oregon, that amount is set at about $206 million. It's on an average of about $19.3 million a year for the 10-year period, so that at that time you have about $95 million coming in a revenue stream. And to sort of summarize where what's happened, how the money's been used or dedicated, the $338 million that comes in by the end of this biennium essentially was not dedicated, but it was appropriated. So it's gone. I expect through for the years 2003-04 through 2005-06 that about $54 million is going to be sold to the Master Settlement Asset Corporation. About $15.8 needed to retire the OHSU debt, and a balance of about $100,000, okay, which would be available essentially for appropriation. Then in 06-07, basically the way that the corporation is set out is they would still get their money, the $54 million, but they will have paid off the bonds and have no need for that money, and it reverts back to the state. So we get back a payment from the Master Settlement Corporation of about $43 million, which, and it, we still have the OHSU debt, and that's expected to last for about 20 years. But that would leave $44 million available in that year for legislative appropriation. Then as you move into that 10-year period, 2017, well, from 07 through 17, you've got about $80 million a year. And that amount goes down when the strategic payment is eliminated. But it's going up in my estimates here, but it's going up because my inflation adjustment is stronger than my volume adjustment. Okay, now that may not be true. Moving to alcoholic beverages. Basically, we've got a tax on malt beverages, which are beer and hard cider. Tax on wine, again, which are products less than 21% alcoholic content, which are distributed through the private sector. And then a tax on the, or no tax, but a profits and revenues resulting from the distribution of distilled spirits by OLCC. And I guess to back up for a second, all of the all of these revenues are sort of subject to the same distribution formula. So I'm going to go through that first, and then we'll look at each individual one. The distribution formula, the privilege taxes on beer and wine. 2 cents comes off the top and goes to support the wine board. The balance then, which of the wine tax plus the beer tax, 50% goes to mental health, and 50% is included in the distribution with the profits from OLCC's operations. And the way they're distributed, the combined total is 56% to the state general fund, 10% to the counties by population. And then the cities get two distributions, 20% of the revenue on a population basis and 14% of the revenue on a formula, which is intended to compensate cities more if their tax burden is high. So if the city has high other taxes relative to other cities, its tax effort is higher, and the formula compensates them more than it does cities where tax effort is lower. Beer tax rates. Going back to 1933, it was a dollar, and the basis of the tax has always been per barrel, which is 31 gallons. So it's a dollar for 31 gallons. In 35, that was increased to $1.30, and in 75 to $1.95, and the last increase in 1977 was to $2.60 per barrel, and that's equivalent to 8.38 cents per gallon, which is about 0.8 of a cent per 12-ounce beer can. Okay.
We got to bring that down, Mr. Chair.
Oregon's ranking, again, just looking at the excise tax rate, Oregon is 42nd among the states, and actually drops to 50 if you add sales taxes, and that distribution is in the Oregon Public Finance document. Beer tax raised $6.4 million. And again, it pretty much follows that distribution formula. 50% goes into mental health, And the balance, the other 50%, 56% of it goes into the general fund. So of the total 28%, 5% to the counties and 17% to the cities.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Is that the $6.4 million, that's the total amount that the beer tax raises, is that right?
Yeah.
$6.4 million a year. Okay.
The history, again, is pretty stable. 77 was the last increase, so the tax rate is constant throughout this period at $2.60. I'm not sure what else to say about this, but that
has there been a citizen initiative activity on the beer tax or on beer and wine, or just no activity at all since 1977?
There's been legislative bills introduced, none passed, and no initiative petitions that I'm aware of, which would have increased that.
Yeah.
Wine tax now, we have two different rates depending upon the alcoholic content. Table wine, essentially, is wine with less than 14% alcohol. And we do have a rate for every year on table wines. Dessert wines are wines mostly vermouth, essentially between 14 and 21%. And what happens with these is sometimes they're distributed publicly, i.e. through OLCC, and sometimes they're distributed privately. So when they're distributed privately, there's no rate. And so what we find over this period is those dessert wines moving into and out of OLCC control. Now what you have essentially is a 25-cent rate and an increase to 30, and at the same time a privatization, if you like, of dessert wines and taxed at the same rate. Then in 44, nationalize or deprivatize dessert wines, they were put back under OLCC, the rate was not changed. And then in 49, the rate falls back down to 23 cents. And then in 74, again, dessert wines were privatized, the tax on table wine remaining at 23 cents and the tax on dessert wine going to 50 cents. All right, so they were privatized, but the tax rate was increased substantially. Then in 75, you have an increase in both. And then in 77, you have the last sort of tax increase except for the wine board. And that was to 67 cents for table wine and 65 cents for table wine and 75 for dessert wine. The last increase then was the increase that essentially established the wine board and gave them 2 cents off of wine from either source. So the total rates now are 67 and 77 cents. Again, looking at the ranking two ways, if you look only at the excise tax, Oregon is 23rd for table wine. I can't really put together a decent comparison for dessert wine. It's all over the place as you try to look from state to state. But they're fairly comparable for table wine. And Oregon comes in about 23rd. If you add sales tax, Oregon drops down to 45th. Sales tax is important, as you can see, on wines because they tend to be a more expensive product. And I've simply used a value of $10, I think, per bottle. $10 a gallon. Is that right? Now I forget what I did use. A fairly low rate or sales price.
I can get $10 a gallon.
Fortified wine.
$30 a gallon for wine. So a fifth of that is $6 a bottle. Normal bottles. So if you were buying real fine wine, the sales tax would be even more significant.
I just wonder what Dick was drinking at $10 a gallon.
You would have paid him more if he was.
It was screw cup. That's all we know for sure.
The wine tax is about comparable with the beer tax in terms of revenue raised. Last year, $6.1 million. Again, slightly less than 50% going to mental health because 2 cents is coming off the top to go to the wine board. Otherwise, the distribution is fairly similar. General fund getting 27%, counties 5%, cities 16%. And then the 2 cents out of the 67 essentially amounts to about a 3% of the revenue going to the wine board. History, you do see some changes here in the tax rates, but most of this is behavior again. And you can see that table wine dominates. The light blue is table wine, essentially, and the dark blue dessert wine. And so the table wine is where the revenue is as far as where the revenue comes from. You find periods, I think, where social stigma essentially attached with wine drinking and health benefits or detriments attached with it influence consumption, I think, more than anything else.
Price, too?
No, because really? This is an excise tax. It's per volume.
No, I understand, but I'm saying that in terms of the behavior, I mean, you know, Trader Joe's changed the world. You know, they're selling good wine for $2 and something a bottle now.
What do you recommend?
Yeah, well, and it would be the definition.
I only drink the stuff that has a head on it. That would be called beer. My wife's the wine snob.
Moving now to the profit, essentially, that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission makes off of its operations with respect to distilled spirits. The way that operates is basically the Liquor Control Commission goes out and purchases wine from a manufacturer. The price that it includes then as a base price is what it costs them, essentially, to purchase the wine or the liquor, plus the federal tax on that, plus the cost of shipping to get it to Oregon, to the OLCC warehouse. Then they mark up that in terms of determining the price that it sells at in their agent stores. And so the markup determines essentially the amount of revenue that we're going to get. And that, as you can see, we start out here at about 83%, 84%, something like that. Then it increased somewhat in the early 80s with the recession, and that was intentional to try and provide additional revenues to help offset revenue shortfalls.
Does the OSCC Commission, do they set the markup rate, or is it by formula?
I believe it's set by the commission. However, the governor and, basically DAS pretty much recommend what
the markup rate will be.
We tried, it seems, in revenue in 2000 and or maybe it was 1999, the legislature tried to tamper with that, and we had testimony from OLCC saying that they had done analysis on what the markup would be and what the loss of volume would be if the markup was too high. So the legislature has the ability, I guess, to do it.
Statutorily, absolutely.
Well, a lot of the discussions we've had in the past have been with privatization of OLCC and the substitution of a tax on the distribution of alcoholic beverages. And I'm sure there's been discussion among members about, we can raise a little more revenue if we just increase the markup. But I've never seen a bill which mm-hmm. would have directed OLCC to increase the markup.
Mm-hmm. Senator, we had one of our revenue options, recall, in the interim revenue options committee. That was one of the things that we looked at and got testimony on.
Yeah, I believe that in the early 80s, it was the governor, essentially, sort of in agreement with the legislator's body as to how they were going to solve this problem that directed OLCC to raise the market.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Do we know how much money that the, talking about privatizing OLCC, is there an amount of money that would save the state?
We've made estimates of that in the past. In general, we found it very difficult to find a tax rate high enough to generate the amount of revenue that's generated by the profit on the LCC operations. The modeling that you do, just basically when you put it into the private sector distribution and you impose the markups and so on that that occur in other states on the distribution of alcoholic beverage, and you impose an elasticity, it's just hard to get a tax rate high enough, because as the rate goes up, consumption goes down, or at least taxable consumption goes down, because again you start hitting compliance problems. But the rate would certainly have to be very high, and if we had a rate comparable with other states, we would lose revenue.
So it actually, let me just repeat this, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So in the event that the legislature would pass legislation to privatize the OLCC system and institute a system that's similar to what other states have that don't have a state system, it would likely be that we would actually lose revenue to the state's general fund budget in doing that.
Well, I hate to make a blanket statement like that, but I expect that would be true. We'd have to look at an individual bill in terms of what it actually does to determine what the revenue impact is. But I think more likely than not, you would lose revenue.
Yes. Very good. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
And I think that's a point really well made. When you look at those wonderful people at AOI that have publicly made the claim that you can gain $600 million to the general fund by privatizing OLCC without giving any evidence as to how that would actually occur. That's one of, you know, Buttrick's 54 ways to leave your lover and improve the state economy.
Right, that makes no sense.
Yeah, that's my view. I mean, it's not only a matter of it being revenue neutral. I mean, that you can't even get the tax high enough to have it a neutral behavior.
Tomorrow's agenda.
Make $600 million.
That is on tomorrow's agenda.
The 54 ways to save state government money?
Well, we're going to hear from AOI tomorrow. So
oh, Yahoo.
Come ready.
We are?
My heart soars like an eagle.
Again, trying to...
You want us to focus again, Dave? Sorry.
Thank you.
I didn't ask any questions.
Thank you, Mr.
I was just making a bunch of statements.
Were you recognized by the chair?
He doesn't recognize.
Just trying to again think about behavior a little bit. Again, what you have in green is the population growth in Oregon, and what you have in red is the number of cases actually sold by OLCC. And at least over this period, we're dealing with the same types of products. We don't have dessert wine in here. Or at least dessert wine is being distributed through the private sector. OLCC may also provide it, but that's a constant throughout this period. What you find is a reduction, actually, in the volume. Now, I don't think this is a very good measure of volume, because I'm not real sure. The definition of cases changes over time, but it's the best thing I've got to try and get at volume. What you find is a decrease in the volume per capita that's being consumed over this period. But if you look at the value of the product being consumed, that's behaves throughout maybe up to the early 90s here is fairly constant with respect to population. And lately we see a little increase. Now that could be either increased consumption or just increased price. If the product price is going up at the national level, of course, that base that OLCC uses is growing, and then they're imposing the 100% markup on top of that. So any increase there could reflect either increased consumption or just increased price.
Better stuff.
Revenues. Total revenues to OLCC, this includes everything, their total operations, essentially $271 million. And this is for 1 year, 2001-2002. 47% of that is that cost of the product that they purchased. So it's the manufactured price plus shipping plus federal tax. 14% then are operations, operating expenses. This includes the compensation of the retailers for their agency stores, includes the cost that they incur in wholesale distribution. And, you know, whatever other programs are directed, the legislature directs them to do,
mm-hmm.
Such as enforcement programs and other types of activity.
Is that 14%, do you know offhand, and Paul, you might know this, is that on par with the lottery or other in terms of saved for administrative costs instead of going into the distribution flow? Do you know if that's on par?
Mr. Chairman, Dick probably knows this better, but we do have on the lottery a 16% constitutional limit. But we also know that the video poker has considerably lower administrative costs than the traditional lottery does. Dick, you want to add?
Well,
that?
Yeah, that just the way lottery counts dollars makes it questionable as to whether that's you can make a reasonable comparison between the two. Because on a video game, sales are essentially not only the dollars somebody puts into the machine, but any game they win. So if they're winning a lot of games, there's a lot of sales, and you have the same expense as if they weren't winning any games. So you know, what you use as a yardstick there to measure the percent expenses as a percent of what is not comparable to ordinary types of business activities. It's useful and necessary for a lottery to use that way of analyzing it, because basically that's the way the national people that are providing those games talk about and deal with those types of operations. Anyway, the net sales then from their operations are 33% of that $271 million. They pick up an additional 1% in license fees and another 5% in those privilege taxes we were talking about, beer and wine. The total then here is $104 million out of the $271 that's available essentially for distribution. And this is the way that was distributed then in the last year. 53% of it, or a little over $50 million, going into the state general fund. 9% to the counties, 32% to the cities, and when you take that total 104, the amount going to the wine board is less than 1%. Again, the history, you find much more variation in the distribution of revenues from OLCC. I think that some of these sharp differences are just movement of revenue in and out of expense accounts or reserve accounts, for a new building or for operations that don't occur smoothly over time. But in general, we do see a significant period here of increasing money available for distribution from OLCC. 911 access charge. In 1981, when this was passed, it was 3% of the access charge that the phone company makes on an individual's bill, separating access from long distance and so on. And that worked fairly well for a period of time, about 10 years up until 1981. And at that time, there was a lot of movement to make the 911 emergency communication network better. They're called PSAPs, Principal Public Access Points, I think it is, where the phone network where people actually call in and where the calls go out to dispense emergency services to a particular place. To consolidate those and to make the system better, and there wasn't enough money, so that access charge was increased to 5% temporarily to try to build a better system. What also started happening at that time is a tremendous increase in the number of cell phones out there. And a lot of disagreement about whether, one, the cell phones were actually liable for the tax, and if so, how do you compute the access charge? Because, of course, what they have is a monthly billing, and as part of that billing, you're allowed so many minutes of long-distance service. So what's the access charge? And over a period of years then, by 1995, the problem is resolved. Essentially, there were court suits that were pending during that period by the cell companies. And it was essentially resolved by converting it to a tax per phone, which has access to the 911 emergency communication network. And that's 75 cents per month per circuit, per phone, essentially. If you have a cell phone, you pay 75 cents per month. If you have two cell phones, you pay $1.50 per month. If you have a cell phone and a landline, you pay $1.50 per month. If you got all three of them, you pay, you know, $2.25. So for each phone that has access to that system, you pay 75 cents per month. Revenue generated by this tax, again, first fully effective in 82, 83, and it goes along here for a while, and I'm not sure what caused these differences. You see the increase in the tax rate up to 5%. You see the period in here where there was problems with the cell phones, essentially. And then once the tax rate is established at 75 cents per phone, you see fairly significant growth in the amount of revenue that's generated by that tax. Now, I would expect this to peak off because the growth in landlines has been fairly constant, and that would, I expect, will continue pretty close to population changes. But the growth in cellulars has been dramatic over this period, and there's got to be a saturation point out there. You know, when everybody's got six cell phones, that's it. It's not going to grow anymore. So I would expect that growth rate to taper off in the future.
Before we leave 911, and so when we enacted the 75 cents, that's statutorily directed to the counties?
It goes into a fund, and basically the manager of that fund is the emergency, state police.
State police.
But you specify right now, as it came out of the special session, you specify essentially the amount of money that's going to be distributed back to the local public safety access points, the local counties and areas that are involved in this emergency network. And any balance over that, I think it's $56 million, I hate to quote numbers like that from memory, but because, that's more fiscal area. But I think it's $56 million that goes back during this biennium to the local governments. And any excess over that, then partially the special session tapped that for general fund purposes, so there's going to be transfers.
Stole it.
So, but is it permanently, or was that a one-time?
That's a one-time.
It's one-time. Because the growth is pretty, so we could have the same situation where the reserves are built up again if past patterns stay true to the future.
Yeah.
And that reserve fund would, I would guess, will grow again now that we tapped it in the special session.
This is an interesting point of disagreement and argument, essentially, among different sectors, if you like, as to whether or not this is a tax, really. Is it a fee where you're really trying to support a certain type of service, which is this emergency management network, which serves those people that have telephones?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a tax so that you can raise general fund revenue with that? Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the question. As we've moved here into the last few years, there probably is more money in there than really necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You could lower the tax rate, or you could treat it as a tax and use some of that money for general fund purposes. That was part of the discussion in the 2001 legislature,
mm-hmm.
and you should have that same discussion.
But, Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I mean, the one thing to keep in mind, though, that's part of that is the changes in technology happening through this time are such that money that never could have been anticipated to have been used for reverse 911 is now a possibility. And that was the argument that many of us used, that stealing the top part of it could have gone to expanding the reverse 911, which they now have the capability of doing.
I presume you mean, I'm not familiar with the term reverse 911, but you mean where they can go back and identify the location
correct.
Of the cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Correct, the physical address. And so, it would look, without that technological change, it would look like, yeah, barely. I mean, the pot keeps increasing and the PSAPs don't increase, the population increases a little, so maybe you could argue that would cost a little bit, but not at the same rate as the is the climb in revenue, but we have another need for that now.
That was certainly all part of the discussion, and, mm-hmm. and part of the fact that, you know, somebody saw there was money sitting out there not being used is because that money was being put aside for the implementation of what you're calling reverse 911 in this upcoming biennium. Mm-hmm. And now that money is not going to be available. So if you want to do that, you're going to have to find money, and,
right.
and this tax may provide enough, it may not. So, you know, you're left with those same types of decisions.
Well, yeah, plus you have the additional public safety problem of radio, the new technology in radios being such that you have the state police, for instance, purchasing some additional radio types of radio, and then you have places like the city of Springfield that haven't been able to afford to do that as a city, and now the dispatchers in these PSAPs have to listen to the two radios because the state police can't talk to the city police. I mean, it's scary stuff when you think about it, and it's all related to, you know, to the same public service function, public safety function.
But this, but that graph, I mean, if those patterns continue, and noted that you're not going to see, if that's true, you're not going to see that type of growth. If those patterns continue, you ought to be able to
right.
purchase new technology and still have a reserve, which would lead us to discussion of, is the 75 cents, do we lower the tax or do we use it for other purposes once you've...
Well, we're going to have to grow more ears if we're going to use cell phones at any greater rate than we do now. I've seen you and your Volvo driving down from Portland, Mr. Chair, with both ears full of cell phones.
Mr. Yates.
Where's Springfield again?
Well, he doesn't know where Springfield is.
Illinois.
Fuel taxes are taxes, I think, in the sense that they raise general purpose. But they're also earmarked. And so, in a sense, they're user fees because it's people that are using the highways that pay the tax. And the money in Oregon, at least, does, in fact, go to maintaining the road system because the Constitution requires that. We have two fuel taxes on the books, essentially. The first one is called a motor vehicle fuel tax, and the second is called a use fuel tax. But those names are not really very instructive in terms of the difference in those taxes. The first tax is really on gasoline, but what it's on legally is any fuel the chief use of which is for the propulsion of a motor vehicle or an air propulsion of an aircraft. Now, diesel fuel and propane and kerosene and fuels like that don't fall in this category because it's not their principal use. Home heating is still a principal use of diesel oil. And so that's taxed under a separate tax called the use fuel tax. In terms of administration, the difference in these two is that the gasoline tax, the motor vehicle tax, is imposed on all fuel. And if you don't use it for a taxable purpose, then you're eligible for a refund. And with the use fuel tax, the tax is only imposed if you use that fuel for a taxable purpose, propulsion of a motor vehicle. So that's the difference in these two taxes. They're both at 24 cents in Oregon. The tax with the fuel is used to propel a piston-driven aircraft or anything which is not jet. I couldn't think of anything else. It's 9 cents, and if it's jet fuel, it's 1 cent per gallon. Now, basically what we have are a number of in-lieu taxes with respect to the fuel tax, and that is for vehicles over 26,000 pounds, they don't pay fuel taxes. What they pay in Oregon is a weight mile tax, and that is essentially based on the weight of the vehicle and the number of miles that you drive in Oregon. There are two other sort of in-lieus. That is, if you are under the weight mile tax, you qualify in that you're driving over 26,000 pounds. But if you're hauling certain types of commodities, you may alternatively pay a flat fee, which is based on the weight of the vehicle and just an annual fee. The other case is the road use assessment fee, which is imposed on non-divisible loads. So if you're hauling the spruce goose across Oregon, you got to get enough axles under that thing to meet the maximum axle loads. But you don't pay the weight mile tax, you don't pay fuel tax, you pay a road use assessment fee. History of motor vehicle fuel taxes. What I did here for comparison purposes was to compute, in addition to the actual rate, which is the light blue, a dark blue rate, which is a rate which would have the same purchasing power as the current 24-cent rate. Okay, so in 1968, the rate was 7 cents, and that had or a rate of about, you know, a little less than 5 cents would have had the same purchasing power as the 24-cent rate does today. So in a sense, you had more real purchasing power at that time than you do today. That's a 10-year period up, or excuse me, 14-year period up to 1982. And during that period, inflation really eroded the purchasing power of the tax. So even though the rate goes here to 8 cents, I think, yeah, it went up 8 cents. Basically, it's increasing either 1 or 2 cents for each time it increases. The purchasing power had been eroded so that it's considerably below the purchasing power of today's tax. And that, as a result, you saw several 1-cent increases. Let me get the chart here. I didn't write that one down. But basically, we're up to 12 cents in 1986, 14 cents by 1988, and the as you can see, actually, the increases, which I think was three cents here to 18 cents in 1990, actually brought you back up to where you're better off than you are today. Then in 91, the legislature passed three successive 2-cent increases in 91, 92, and 93, and that's the last increase in the tax rate was in 1993. And so it's the same today. And you can see how the purchasing power of that tax rate has declined between 1993 and 2002.
Did they do that in three separate bills, or did they do it one bill with a step increase?
One bill with three effective dates.
Yeah,
probably
revised
or amended the statute three separate times with three different effective dates.
Yeah.
Again, you can see a rather dramatic increase in the amount of revenue. I should have put this in real terms to make it comparable, I guess, with the last graph, but I didn't think of it. And primarily, you know, the things that control this are vehicle miles of travel, efficiency of the vehicles that are actually on the road. You can sort of argue to a certain extent that there was a period here where vehicles were becoming more efficient, and then a period where the SUVs became popular.
And that corresponds to when Ron Deckard bought his Volvo. Looks to me.
Mr. Yates, do not let Senator Corcoran know what kind of car you drive, or you just endless the commentary.
It's a little red station wagon. It came with its own little baby seats. It's just totally, you know, Portland yuppie.
Yeah. I would just remind my colleague to my right that Washington County is very well represented to your left here, which is primary.
And we stick together, too.
Yuppies, RD, doesn't matter. Yuppies, yuppies, young kids.
A quick look at how the weight mile taxes are structured. We'll get into this more when we get into some of these questions. But basically, there are two tables. Table A applies to weights up to 80,000 pounds. And basically, it doesn't matter there how many axles you have under that vehicle. You're paying based on the weight alone. It runs from about 3.6 cents per mile at 26,000 pounds up to about 12 cents a mile at 80,000 pounds. You go above 80,000 pounds, you're basically subject to a graduated rate which varies both with the weight of the vehicle and the number of axles under the vehicle. The in-lieu taxes are for log trucks, sand and gravel trucks, and chip trucks. And we'll look at each one of these. And then there's the road use assessment fee. So all of these are essentially weight mile taxes. The weight mile tax itself looks like this. This is listed as 5 axles, but below 80,000 pounds, doesn't matter how many axles, you pay the same rate. The rate is based on weight only. And this is how the rates look. Once you move above 80,000 pounds, then, for instance, up here at about 92,000 pounds, there is an advantage to putting more axles under the vehicle in terms of the reduction in the mile per mile cost for driving over Oregon roads. Some people argue that that's an incentive for people to use more axles. The calculations and work that I've done suggest it probably isn't. That the cost and the amount of cargo that you lose by putting, in other words, you're going to stay an 80,000 pound truck, which you have to if you're coming out of California. You put another axle under there, you give up 2,500 pounds of cargo, because that's the weight of the axle. It probably does not offer a reasonable incentive for people to put more axles under there. And the way I prefer to think of this is, we'll get into cost responsibility later, but basically we're trying to charge rates and fuel taxes or in weight mile charges on vehicles in proportion to the amount of damage that they do to the roads. And clearly, if you put more axles under a vehicle of a given weight, you're doing less damage to the roads. And so from a cost responsibility standpoint, it's only fair, essentially, to charge less when you're doing less damage. And so whether or not these constitute sufficient incentives to actually modify behavior, at least they're fair in terms of the overall cost responsibility approach to taxation. The in-lieu taxes, these right now for log trucks are $555 per hundredweight. Let's see what I got here. So on an 80,000 pound vehicle, essentially the annual tax here would for a log truck is $4,440. So, you know, an 80,000 pound truck has got 800 hundredweights, and you multiply each of those by 555, and you're paying about $4,000 in tax. The chip truck is paying about $17,920 annually in tax. And these rates are supposed to be set. The way these work is, the individual trucker does not have to report miles on a tax form, at least. They just pay the quarterly or annual payment for the tax. But on average, for everybody, some drive a lot of miles, some don't drive very many miles, and on average, they're supposed to be paying the same in these in-lieu taxes they would pay if they were under the weight mile tax. So they're supposed to be revenue neutral. And the Department of Transportation is supposed to come in and recommend rates each biennium that in fact are revenue neutral. It's up to you people to put those in statute. The road use assessment fee, and again we'll get more later into what an ESIL is. It's an equivalent single axle load, essentially, and it came about as a result of trying to determine highway pavement damage. And what they came up with was an 18,000 pound standard. And the ESIL is essentially to take whatever that axle load is, say it's 20,000 pounds, you divide it by 18,000, and then you raise that for a single axle to the 3.8 power. So you can see ESILs are going to go up very rapidly as weight increases because it's being raised to a fairly high power. And so that's really trying to get at the amount of pavement damage that each axle is doing. So if you're under that road use assessment fee, if you're bringing a spruce goose across to Oregon or some big rocket engine or something that can't be divided up into truckloads, you pay this road use assessment fee, and that's 5.2 cents per ESIL mile. And I did a calculation. It varies, you know, if you have tandem axles, tritem axles, and there's a lot of... fortunately, ODOT produces a table so that the individual trucker can just look up what the fee is on the table. But I calculated what the road use assessment would be for a 132,000-pound truck, which constitutes six single axles. So you got six axles of 20,000 pounds, a 12,000 pound steering axle, and that's 47.7 cents per mile. So it can get pretty expensive, but you can move large loads across Oregon. That might be the end. No. Oh, weight mile tax revenue. Again, this, what you find as a result of cost responsibility, and we'll get more into that later, but you find pretty much proportional increases in the fuel tax and in the weight mile tax rates so that you maintain that proportionality. And so you see the same factors in causing an increase in the weight mile tax revenues. That is increased VMT, probably stronger among heavy vehicles than light vehicles. But increased VMT on Oregon roads and increased weight mile taxes, increased charges per mile that they drive. And what you find up here at the end, the reason for this drop-off is action by the legislature essentially to reduce the weight mile tax rates as a result of the 99 car highway cost allocation study. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Yates, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sorry you had to endure some sidebar commentary.
As soon as we go off the record, I'm going to tell you a really funny story about cell phones. One of our colleagues.
Tomorrow we have, you're going to be disappointed to hear that we do not have an orientation tomorrow. We have the Measure 28 results and then analysis and a debate from four groups, AOI, NFIB, AFL-CIO, and the
OCPP.
OCCP.
OCPP.
Thank you very much. We are adjourned.